I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times.
As President of the United States, I will always put America first. Just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first.
President Trump said the words sovereign and sovereignty more than 20 times in his speech yesterday before the UN General Assembly. He criticized North Korea and put its leader Kim Jong-un on notice.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
And he had nothing good to say about the Iran nuclear deal that President Obama negotiated with other world powers.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it, believe me.
Joining us is Ed Luce. He's Financial Times columnist, wrote a book called The Retreat of Western Liberalism. And Ed, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Do we have him? Nice to have you back on Radio Times.
Yeah, it's great to be back with you. Thank you.
That was a very nervous-making pause there. Well, where to begin, Ed Luce? Let me begin with the word sovereign or sovereignty that the president used something like 21 times in his speech. As you listen to that speech, how is he defining that word?
He's defining that word in order to fit the America First message he wants to pitch really to his base in America. And I think the audience was ostensibly global leaders there in the UN Convention Hall in New York. But the message was very much delivered to the voters, perhaps of Alabama most immediately in mind, rather than to diplomats around the world. And I think that's how it's been interpreted around the world.
Well, it's interesting because U.S. sovereignty was under threat by Russian interference in the 2016 election. Of course, Russia violated Ukraine's sovereignty a couple of years ago. What do you make of that?
Well, he mentioned China and Russia elliptically once when he said Ukraine's sovereignty was under threat and South China Sea sovereignty was under threat. But he did not actually call out Russia by name in connection with Ukraine. The only mention he made of Russia was to thank it for cooperation at the United Nations. In terms of China, the disputed atolls and islands and coral reefs in the South China Sea, America has no position on them. So to say that their sovereignty is under threat makes very little sense. I think the really interesting part of the speech is that he calls out four countries, Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, and Cuba, for threatening America's sovereignty, but essentially lets Russia and China off the hook. And it's interesting that neither Vladimir Putin nor Xi Jinping are attending this year's UN General Assembly.
Oh, that really is interesting. You said in your piece that this speech was written by Stephen Miller. Do you know that, or does it just have that Stephen Miller, Steve Bannon fingerprint to it?
I haven't spoken to Stephen Miller, but it's been reported by colleagues that he's the principal author of that speech, but it's absolutely got his fingerprints all over it. This was not a speech that was penned by, Jim Mattis or H.R. McMaster. This is a muscular, bellicose America First speech, and Stephen Miller is the author of those.
He said, "The righteous many need to confront the wicked few, or evil will triumph." And it did remind me of President Bush's speech about the axis of evil, of course, minus Iraq. There's something almost biblical about that language.
There is, and you're right. That does echo the 2002 Bush address to the UN, to Congress. But the difference is that for all of the criticisms of George Bush, there was a larger values system in which he placed that, namely the promotion of democracy and freedom. Trump departed from that script very sharply by saying each country should be strong, sovereign, independent, follow its own values, its own destiny, and that we work together where it might suit us. And I think, you know, as we were discussing earlier with Russia and China, it's pretty confusing to people which countries Trump has singled out and which he hasn't. There doesn't seem to be a code there or a formula there to figure out which.
He calls it principled realism. Does that fit for you?
It's a catchy phrase. The realism is something that makes sense. The principled bit is what I think has left people confused, is what are the principles? Is it freedom and stability? Is it prosperity? Is it interaction between nations? And if and when it isn't any of those things, what are the rules for deciding who is a pariah and who isn't? And Trump didn't really make any effort to set out the philosophy behind the principled bit of principled realism.
Well, let me ask you about North Korea. Do you think the president drew a line in the sand when he talked about essentially bombing that country and North Korea being on a suicide mission itself?
I think he certainly set a line in the sand. And his comment about totally destroying North Korea was if North Korea attacked any of America's allies, Japan, South Korea, etc., or the American mainland. But the sentence that immediately followed about Rocket Man on a suicide mission was again a little bit confusing, because it implies to Kim Jong-un, you know, the one of the primary listeners to that speech, that Trump doesn't believe he's rational. And if Trump doesn't believe he's rational, that means that Trump, in Kim Jong-un's mind, might be preparing a preemptive strike on North Korea. And that is the situation where North Korea itself would act preemptively. So again, some confusion, some departure there with the Rocket Man comment from conventional deterrent policy.
Although, interestingly, back in last year, 2016, at the UN, President Obama said, and I'm quoting here, the U.S. could obviously destroy North Korea. Did President Trump say anything distinctly different from that?
He implied that he didn't think Kim Jong-un was sane. And Obama didn't go that far. And that, of course, completely changes, or has the potential to completely change, Kim Jong-un's own calculations. So that's the difference. Obama was sticking to very boilerplate language that if you attack us, we will respond overwhelmingly. Trump said that, but he went further by hinting quite strongly that America could attack first.
Does it sound like the United States or the Trump administration wants to pull the United States out of the Iran deal, the way the president spoke?
It does. I think if you call it an embarrassment and you say we're going to be hearing more about this, believe me, that's a pretty strong hint. He has to certify the Iran deal in mid-October to Congress. And if he doesn't, Congress has 60 days in which to impose new sanctions on Iran. And at that point, if Congress did that, or if Trump himself used his presidential authority to impose sanctions, then the other parties to the agreement, namely China, Germany, France, Britain, and Russia, would have basically certified the United States as having unilaterally withdrawn from the deal. So they're in a panic. They're interpreting, particularly the Europeans, they're interpreting Trump's words as saying he's likely to do this, and they're doing their best through public and private diplomacy to persuade President Trump not to.
Is there a deal without the United States?
There is. Most of Iran's trade is, you know, with Europe, and a lot of it is with Russia. And if the other five signatories to the agreement decide to continue with it, and Iran does too, crucially, obviously, then the deal could continue and the United States could be the outlier. But of course, if the US withdrew, Iran's hardliners would probably feel emboldened because they've got the same critique coming from the other extreme as the as some of the Trump critiques of the deal. And they would then bolster their argument for following North Korea's lead and going nuclear quickly. So that's a real danger.
It'll be interesting to hear what the Iranian leader says today as he addresses the United Nations.
Indeed, Rouhani is speaking there this morning in New York. And his goal will be the same as the Europeans. He wants to keep this intact, and he wants to keep his own hardliners in Iran, at bay, in check. And I think from his point of view, Trump's words will have strengthened Rouhani's enemies. So he has quite a delicate task in the words he chooses. He's got to hit back against Trump hard, but without encouraging Trump to go over the cliff.
How do you think this speech was received? I saw the camera panning the audience. I have to say Benjamin Netanyahu seemed very happy about it. Much has been made of General Kelly's body language. At one point, he's holding his head. You know, sometimes you can read more into something than actually exists. But how would you say this played with the General Assembly?
Well, I wasn't in the General Assembly, so I can't give you firsthand. But colleagues who were there say that it was pretty quiet and pretty stunned for most of the speech. There was audible concerned chatter when President Trump made the comment about Rocket Man. Because that was very close to a sort of declaration of war. But Benjamin Netanyahu really gave it wild applause and described it as the most courageous speech a president has given to the UN. So this was exactly what he wanted to hear. Israel has been lobbying. If you remember, Netanyahu himself addressed Congress. It was unprecedented to try and persuade them to vote down the deal President Obama negotiated. So for him, it was manna from heaven. It was exactly what he wanted to hear.
We have almost no time for the answer to this question, but the president has criticized the United Nations for a number of things. Does it deserve some level of criticism?
It does indeed. It does indeed. And I think America does contribute proportionately more than most countries. I think it is hopelessly, in many respects, hopelessly bureaucratic, particularly at its headquarters in New York. And Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, agrees with the Trump administration on some of these points.
Ed Luce, we are losing you. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times by Skype. And he's Financial Times columnist. And we were talking about President Trump's speech to the United Nations yesterday. And coming up next, we'll be talking about dinosaurs and fossils. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. If you're looking for dinosaur fossils, you could go to Ellesmere Island north of the Arctic Circle like paleontologist Ted Deschler did when he co-discovered a 375-million-year-old fish, Tiktaalik rosiae. Or you could go to Patagonia in South America as paleontologist Kenneth Lacavora did a couple of years ago when he discovered the 77-million-year-old bones of a giant plant-eating dinosaur he named Dreadnoughtus. Or you could go to a 65-acre quarry behind a strip mall in New Jersey filled with dinosaur bones from a mass extinction 65 million years ago. Ted Deschler and Kenneth Lacavora join us on Radio Times to talk about their dinosaur adventures, their discoveries, what these creatures can teach us about the world, about survival, and about extinction. Ted Deschler is associate curator and chair of vertebrate zoology at the Academy of Natural Sciences. He's also associate professor in the Department of Biodiversity, Earth, and Environmental Science at Drexel University. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times, Ted Deschler.
Thanks, Marty. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And Kenneth Lacavara is founding dean of the School of Earth and Environment at Rowan University, director of the Gene and Rick Edelman Fossil Park in New Jersey. That's the one I just mentioned. And he's got a new book called Why Dinosaurs Matter. And Ken, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as
Thanks,
well.
Thanks, Marty. Great to be here.
Nice to have you both here back on Radio Times. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. You know, I was thinking about my son. Most children are what I would call pint-sized paleontologists. They know everything about dinosaurs, and many of them, most of them, move on to something else. What has kept you so fascinated, Ted Deschler, with dinosaurs and fossils? And
So I work in groups of fossils that are actually older than dinosaurs. So dinosaurs being a very specific group of reptiles. But I think dinosaurs do, it's kind of a colloquial term for all things fossil. What I think what keeps me going is the excitement of discovery. Big part of my research program has been exploration, getting out there to new areas and looking for new fossils that give us new information about a period of time and a place on the Earth at that time. So it's really that discovery that keeps me going.
Ken, you were a musician before you became a paleontologist. Do I have that right?
I was, yeah. I knew I wanted to be a paleontologist and geologist when I was very young, but I didn't really see a path from A to B, and I found out in high school that I was pretty good at playing the drums.
Oh, really?
And I went that way, and I toured the country as a musician. I was the house drummer at the Golden Nugget Casino for about a year. And then Carl Sagan's book came out in 1980, and I read it, and it was like he had drilled inside my brain and was answering questions just for me, and I realized I had to find a path then to become a scientist.
Wow. Your book is called Why Dinosaurs Matter. And when I first read it, I said, well, of course dinosaurs matter. But you also talk in the very beginning about how we use the word dinosaur as a pejorative. You want to change that.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, you'll hear that, IBM is a dinosaur.
Exactly.
This political party is a dinosaur. And I always think, you know, they should hope to be so lucky. global dominance for the better part of 165 million years, amazing adaptations, achieving feats that we humans have yet to achieve in many respects. And the dinosaurs are still with us. Birds are, in fact, dinosaurs. And so they span 231 million years. You know, the human existence is really just a rounding error on the Mesozoic timescale. So, you know, to call them failures is really to misunderstand their amazing record.
Now, when I grew up, we misunderstood reptiles to be connected to dinosaurs. I know that's no longer true. It's through science and research and discovery, we've learned that, as you write in this book, that birds are avian dinosaurs.
Birds are. And, you know, it's not correct to say that birds are related to dinosaurs or birds evolved from dinosaurs. Birds are dinosaurs in just the same way that you are a human, but you're also an ape and you're a primate and you're a mammal. And, you know, when we evolved into apes, we didn't get kicked out of the mammal group, or we didn't lose our membership in the club of animals. So birds are birds, but they're also dinosaurs.
Tell us about Tiktaalik Rosie. And I remember, Ted, when you came in after this discovery and how important this discovery was. And again, it's, what, 375 million years ago?
Yeah. When you go back that far in time, you're looking at branches of the family tree that are just very basal, as we would say, very, very primitive organisms. And Tiktaalik is essentially the best transitional form we know of that shows us how features evolved from aquatic finned animals to animals with limbs, first carrying them through shallow ecosystems, shallow aquatic ecosystems. But those structures that we see were part of a lineage that over about 30 million years of time led to the very first limbed animals that could pull themselves out of the water and come on land. And that sort of transition to what we call terrestriality was a huge step in the history of life on Earth, and led to a radiation, a diversification into those land-based ecosystems that included the groups that Ken was just talking about, mammals in one direction, what we would call reptiles in another. There's a distinctive group. We can still use the term reptiles, amphibians in another. And so we look at Tiktaalik particularly as just a very important branch in that complex tree of life. It's funny, in paleontology, we all have our sort of our targets where we're most interested in time and in place. And mine is at that period, whereas others like Ken are in different periods of time.
And your period is the Devonian period.
Correct. And even the late part of the Devonian period.
And you were just in Antarctica last winter.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no shortage of, or there's no, we need more information about fossils, about the history of life. And we go to places where we haven't discovered anything yet. And there we learned of deposits in Antarctica that had potential to preserve animals from this middle to late part of the Devonian period. And, you know, the only way to find them is to go to that effort to organize an expedition and do it. And that's what we did. It was a fantastic trip.
And quiet, too. No birds, no...
Oh, it's really the dead zone down there. It's cold, of course, below freezing. There's no liquid water. You know, you're camping out. You're melting water and that sort of thing. But beautiful. We're in these mountain ranges that stick up through the ice along what's called the Trans-Antarctic Range. And so really, actually, the kind of place paleontologists like to go, because there's no soil and there's no really living organisms. You got the rock and the ice, and we're all over that rock.
You have discovered a number of dinosaurs, Ken, including this Dreadnoughtus in Patagonia in Argentina. And you write in this book about just that sense of discovery, also going to a place for the first time and, I guess, getting a sense of the lay of the land. Where am I going to look? Where am I going to dig? What am I going to find?
Yeah, that's right. You know, all of us paleontologists, we kind of use the same formula. We try to find rocks of the right age. And as Ted said, that's different for the two of us. They have to be sedimentary rocks so a fossil can form. And it's really helpful if today it's a desert or if it's Antarctica where you have good exposure of the rocks. Then you get yourself on the ground and you walk. And, you know, when you crack open a rock and you're the first person to see a page of Earth history, it's just an abiding thrill that I think never goes away, to think, you know, I'm the first human that gets to know this. And, you know, and this thing hasn't seen daylight for, in my case, you know, 65 million years until this very moment. The thrill never goes away.
And there were something like 140 bones that you brought back from that site?
We brought back 145 bones of Dreadnoughtus, 16 tons of bones in an ocean shipping container.
Big dinosaur.
It was
here.
A big dinosaur. That's why my back hurts. It's a very big dinosaur.
Which got me thinking, I mean, what is a dinosaur? As you write in this book, they're big, they're little, they're fast, they're slow. There are many different things that dinosaurs did.
Yeah, that's right. They were so varied. So over 165 million years, they were in every niche on land. So there were big herbivorous dinosaurs. There were large predatory dinosaurs, little predatory dinosaurs, feathered not flying dinosaurs, feathered flying dinosaurs, probably alpine dinosaurs, wetlands dinosaurs. So think of the great richness of mammals today or of birds today. It was just like that. They were, you know, we kind of have this cartoonish image of them as the dinosaurs, but the dinosaurs were so varied. There really is no the dinosaurs.
This book is also about deep time. And you look, Ted, way back, hundreds of millions of years ago, but just what that is about, why that's significant and important and even inspiring.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I teach geology, and one of the things that is really important for every geo major to realize, actually every citizen on Earth, actually, I think, to realize, is that we are just the last speck of time of a long, long, long history of the Earth. And the more we get to grasp that, the more we can understand that the Earth has been going and going, and the processes that have been forming aspects of the Earth that we see are continuing today. But that, especially in the history of life, deep time opens a perspective on biodiversity, on our own impacts on the Earth. You know, we've seen extinction events in the past, and we're seeing an extinction event right now. And we can, deep time gives us, again, a more complete perspective. Without it, we're really just kind of flying by the seat of our pants. And so paleontologists and geologists are, I think, critical to our worldview. And it's been fun to be able to communicate that to people.
You're nodding your head about deep time and the importance of understanding what that is.
Yeah, you know, we are really latecomers on the scene here. And, you know,
we meaning us human beings,
we,
right?
We humans, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you scrunch the whole 4.5 billion year history of the Earth down into a single calendar year with the Earth starting on January 1st, I mean, we think of dinosaurs as being really old. We think of Ted's fish, Tiktaalik, as being really old. Well, Tiktaalik, 375 million years ago, that's about the first week of December on that calendar. Mm-hmm. Dinosaurs show up in the second week, and the non-avian dinosaurs go extinct on Christmas Eve. And, you know, our hominid ancestors, like Australopithecus Lucy, they show up on December 31st at about 3:30 in the afternoon. And our species shows up on the last night of the year at 11:59:59. You know, the ball's dropping, corks are popping, people are kissing. And that's when we show up and we get here and we think it's all about us.
Yes, we do. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. Our guests are paleontologists Ted Deschler and Kenneth Lacavara, and we are talking about dinosaurs and about fossils and their work around the world, and you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, speaking of extinction, and we should talk first about the extinction of the dinosaurs. And you have a pretty vivid description in this book, Ken, about what happened when that meteor hit the Earth and who survived and who died.
Yeah, so it's very clear now that an asteroid about the size of Philadelphia going about 45,000 miles an hour, that's 25 times the speed of a bullet, hits the Earth's crust off the Yucatan Peninsula, blows a crater in the Earth's outer layer that's about the size of Massachusetts times 20 miles deep. Now, imagine what Massachusetts weighs. So you take that material, pulverize it, put it up through the atmosphere. You've given it a tremendous amount of potential kinetic energy, right? And when that stuff comes back in, it's got to balance the energy books. And it does that mostly by heating up the atmosphere that day for a couple of hours. And right now the argument is, was it pizza oven for a few minutes or toaster oven for a few hours? But either way, your dinosaur's dead. And I think that gets back to, you know, the way dinosaur has been used as a pejorative, as these things were losers, they were failures, they couldn't hack it. Well, they were wildly successful, and then they got murdered. You know, it really wasn't
murdered
their
by an
fault.
Asteroid.
Murdered by an asteroid. They'd probably still be here if that asteroid had, you know, been deflected by an infinitesimal fraction of a degree when it was out along the asteroid belt.
Wow. And the ones that survived, I guess, were either in the water or could somehow burrow in the ground?
Yeah, it seems like if you could shelter, you have a chance of surviving. So there's sort of two parallel mass extinctions. One happens in the ocean afterwards because all that dust and gas shroud out the sun, the food chain breaks down, the plankton can't do their thing, and things start to starve. So if you're big and you live in the ocean, you don't have a chance. So big things like mosasaurs die out and other things, lots of other things in the ocean. On land, you have iconic dinosaurs alive at the moment that the asteroid hits. T-Rex happens to be alive at that time. Triceratops happens to be alive. The next day, the largest fully terrestrial creatures, not amphibians like crocodiles or turtles, but fully terrestrial creature is like the size of a cat. Wow. It's absolutely shocking.
Wow. Wow. Mm. Do we know what happened to Tiktaalik Rosiae?
Well, there are mass extinctions through
million.
Time. Yes.
Yes.
And people do talk about some changes in the Devonian period, particularly toward the end of the Devonian period. Not quite as dramatic as what Ken describes. It seems that these extinctions may have been more stepwise, ecosystem change with environmental change, and of course the cascading effects that come from sort of pulling one piece of an ecosystem out and then other things naturally go with it, which is actually pretty instructive to our situation in the world today. So we do see mass extinctions through time. And they're still something that is very interesting for paleontologists to try to fathom, both the mechanisms because it's not always an asteroid. There's lots of other options. But again, something that is relevant to us today is what was that cascading effect of one change that led to another, that led to another, and what organisms did come through that. And so something like Tiktaalik rosae, that lineage of animals clearly was diverse at the time. There's sort of lots of different, you call it evolutionary experimentation in living in a shallow aquatic ecosystem for an animal with fish-like features, but developing some things, including appendages that could hold it up, you know, kind of move through shallow water, the ability to breathe air, the ability to rotate your head side to side. So there were a number of features that were sort of being put through that evolutionary filter at the time. And although we can't say that the species of Tiktaalik that we found is directly on that evolutionary lineage, we talk about that radiation and that somewhere within a whole group of species like Tiktaalik, we led to the first limbed animals that could come to land. And so that's about the best we can do in an evolutionary scenario like that.
Sure, understanding something obviously so long ago. Mm-hmm. We're almost up on a break here, but this 65-acre quarry, it's now part of, I guess, Rowan, and you're involved in this, Ken, but this is from also a mass extinction, it looks like 65 million years ago.
Well, that's the idea that we're testing right now. And so we can see that we have deposits that are right up at the very end of the Cretaceous. We can see that we have a fossil bone bed there. And then in the last few years, we have begun to recover proxies for meteor impact, little beads of glass that rain down from the sky, a spike in the level of iridium. And so we're working on this project right now, and it's looking promising that this may be the only place in the world where you could literally put your finger on a fossil and say that individual died in that pivotal calamitous day that wiped out the dinosaurs and really made the modern world as we know it. And it's in a quarry, you know, behind
in
a
New
Lowe's
Jersey.
In South Jersey. Yeah.
We shouldn't say that despairingly about New Jersey. That's Ken Lacavara. He's a paleontologist. Also with us, Ted Deschler, who's a paleontologist. We are talking about fossils and dinosaurs and some of the work that they have been doing. And again, you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments you might have about dinosaurs or fossils, this is the place. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Ted Deschler and Kenneth Lacavara about dinosaurs and about fossils and what we need to understand about what happened on this earth millions of years ago and what it means for us today. And again, you can join our conversation by calling 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ken, in your new book, Why Dinosaurs Matter, you say we are facing a sixth extinction. You also say that, like the dinosaurs, we have we are in many ways rulers of the land. Quoting here, we're warming the planet, we're melting the glaciers and raising the seas. The carbon dioxide we pump into the atmosphere reacts with seawater and acidifies the oceans, killing the coral reefs. We're cutting down rainforests, filling in wetlands, thawing the tundra, and you go on from there. We are the asteroid, you say. It's worth remembering that it wasn't only the non-avian dinosaurs and three-quarters of life on Earth that perished in the fifth extinction. The asteroid was destroyed as well. You are really raising the alarm here.
Yeah, and I think it should be raised. And, you know, the lesson from all of paleontology is that things don't last forever. And, you know, worlds don't have to have humans any more than they have to have dinosaurs or fish with legs. It's all so contingent. And, you know, we live in a planet that is very finely balanced. The biosphere is so thin when you look at the Earth. If you take an egg, slice the eggshell in half again, and then take off another 40%. That's the thickness of the biosphere compared to the whole planet. So it's delicate, it's small, and it's easy to damage. And, you know, to think that our hegemony on this planet is guaranteed by some, you know, cosmic proclamation of manifest destiny, that's not what the fossil record tells us. And, you know, so now it's not just about, you know, saving the whales and saving the... That's about saving us now. I mean, you know...
Well, one thing you write, I'll put this to you, Ted. One thing that Ken writes is that, you know, the planet essentially is strong, but life is fragile.
Absolutely. And it's got a long, long history that we can try to track, and we can see what has perturbated life in the past. But change is the norm. And we're so used to thinking on this planet, you know, things are always the same. But the opposite. Change is absolutely the norm in Earth science, in history of life, in evolutionary. And we have to sort of embrace that and understand that you know, we're going to have a hard time if we don't sort of see and continue to manage the Earth and the resources that are here.
I think we sometimes think that, you know, evolution is a thing that happened in the past and not acknowledge the fact that it's happening today.
Absolutely true.
I mean, and why wouldn't it, right?
Yes, and physical and biological evolution change.
You want to add to that, Kim?
Yeah, Ted's right. You know, change is the constant that you see in the fossil record. And, you know, as we go forward into the future, we have to look to the past to really understand the changes that we're flying into. You know, nobody remembers the past. I mean, nobody remembers the future, right? We can't do experiments in the future. So where do we get our information to plot our course ahead? It's only by looking back. And it was Winston Churchill who said that the further back you look, the further ahead you can see. So, you know, we have had environmental destruction in the past on Earth. We've had radical climate changes. We've had extinction. We've had bursts of evolution. And we can look back in the fossil record and see how biospheres respond, see how ecosystems respond. And that helps gives us an idea of, you know, what we're about to experience here on Earth.
So what should we do?
Well, we need to stop changing our climatic system because we are not smart enough to do this. You know, we're now at this big machine. Think of it like the console on the Enterprise, right? And we're pulling all the levers, but we don't really know what the levers do. And we are taking our planet and our biosphere in a direction that's dramatic yet unintentional. And, you know, we should not be inadvertently engineering the only home, our lifeboat in space that we have.
Does it feel dire to you? I mean, you're paleontologist.
Well, feels dire in that things are dying, right? You know, we are losing species at a rapid clip. If you look back at the near geological record, we lose a species of mammal about every 1,000 years. In the last 200 years, we've lost over 700. In the last 200 years, yeah, we've lost over 700. So
700 species.
It's dramatic. It's, you know, some people say it's 10 times the rate. Some people say it's 1,000 times the rate. But we are in a sixth extinction right now. For paleontologists in the future, you will see this as an extinction event.
Tate, anything you want to add to that?
No, I thought Ken put that well in good analogies. We really do need to pay attention to how we're changing the Earth with the perspective of geological time. And that was what I was saying earlier, that I think paleontology and geology is about the best we can do to see the past, realize, put ourselves in a perspective of a continuing history, and realize, as Ken said, that we really are flying blind a little bit here, and we ought to be careful.
Who said that phrase, if you don't understand the past, you're sort of doomed to repeat it? Or,
yeah,
you know, there's some
right
version of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let me get, looks like Larry from Upper Darby to join our conversation. Hi, Larry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
If extinction's inevitable, does it apply to humans in kind of a new organism in the biosphere?
Well, so far in the fossil record, what we see is that no species lasts forever. Of course, there has never been humans on the planet until recently. So, you know, we don't know. But, you know, I think it was the writer Larry Niven who said that, you know, single planet species cannot persist. Right. And so eventually what we do know is that eventually the sun is going to swell up when it you know, turns into a red giant and engulf the Earth. I think the Earth has, you know, at most another 5 billion years. So eventually, yeah, humans, if we stay on Earth, are going to go extinct. hopefully not sooner. We actually have within our power right now, you know, the ability to make us go extinct like next Thursday if we really tried hard.
So we could be like Tiktaalik Rozier.
Well, I also feel like that question points out that there's so many different timescales, and many of us understand a human timescale, our own lifetime. But geologic time is a very different thing, and we tend to conflate everything into what we understand and know. And so I would say, well, of course, in geological time, humans will go extinct. But I think what we really care about is a much shorter time scale in thousands or 10,000s or hundreds of thousands of years. And so the question is a very good one. And obviously, we on those time scales, it's of concern.
Let me make a weird leap here, but you mentioned T-Rex, Tyrannosaurus Rex. You also, in your book, describe why it has such puny arms. As I said, a little bit of a weird segue here, but it's worth talking about.
Sure. So, you know, T-Rex is much lampooned about those tiny arms,
yeah.
You know.
What was that about, right?
You know, can't put on a tack, can't answer the phone, can't wipe its bum. It's, you know, terrible things happen on the internet to T-Rex. But there's a paleontologist in Los Angeles, Michael Habib, who has a very brilliant biomechanical explanation for the small arms of T-Rex. And that is, you know, T-Rex had the most powerful bite ever for a land animal. To have a really big bite, you need really big jaw muscles. To have really big jaw muscles, you need a really big head, which necessitates a really big, powerful neck. And the muscles in the neck and the muscles in the arms compete for the same muscle attachment space in the shoulders. So as the bite of T-Rex, as its ancestors, as it got stronger, you see the arms getting smaller and smaller. So really those little arms may be the key to its power and ferocity.
Helps explain why its bite was so ferocious.
Yeah, and makes those arms not so funny when you think about the destruction that mouth could do.
Can we make a line from the arms of T-Rex to the arms of Tiktaalik?
Oh, interesting. Not a direct line. In the case of the transition between fins that were useful for swimming in aquatic settings and then appendages, fins are appendages, but I just... The difference between a fin and a limb is not an overnight thing. There are in-between stages, which we can only see in the fossil record when we compare to the modern world. But yes, you know, you find all through evolution, you find change that is sort of just directed generation after generation. I shouldn't use the word directed, but ends up with a direction generation after generation. And in this case, it's clearly organisms that are adapting for new evolutionary new ecosystems, new ways of making a living. And when there are new opportunities like that on Earth because of other changes and what plants are doing on land or whatever the case might be, you see these sort of life tracking those new opportunities. In the case of T-Rex, having a big, powerful head must have been another way of making a living, chomping on these big herbivorous forms that are in the same habitats. In the case of Tiktaalik, it looks like the opportunity to get into shallow water, to find your food up there, maybe to escape predation behind you in the deeper water, again, was a trend. And so I think we always are seeing organisms fine-tuning for the ecosystems around them.
Let me see what Sheila from Westchester has to say. Sheila, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Sheila. Go ahead.
Yes. Okay. Can you hear me?
Barely.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right. I'll make it quick. I was wondering if the gentleman could speak about any marine dinosaurs. You mentioned there are birds, but are there any under the ocean at this point in time? Thank you.
You're welcome, Sheila.
So that is a common misconception about dinosaurs. All the dinosaurs lived on land. So those big, scary sea creatures like mosasaurs, even though they have sar in their name, they're not dinosaurs. They're marine reptiles. Plesiosaurs, ichthyosaurs, none of those things are dinosaurs. Oh. There are dinosaurs that live in the ocean now, but they're birds, right? Like penguins and things.
Yes, in fact, penguins are dinosaurs, as you write.
None of the non-bird dinosaurs lived in the sea. Those big scary things in the sea are reptiles.
Tell us about what you were doing in the Antarctic and what you brought back.
Sure. Well, we learned about deposits, strata, sedimentary rocks in Antarctica from the late part of the Middle Devonian, about 390 million years old. And the fact that we want to continue to find new fossil material from different parts of the Earth, but within that same time period, is because we want to sort of see the distribution of life on Earth, the biodiversity, what is the range of different forms, where were some of the evolutionary centers of specific adaptations, like the origin of limbs. So Neil Shubin, colleague, University of Chicago, and myself organized and got some grant money to go to Antarctica, to these transantarctic mountains, working out of McMurdo Station, and spend the time to focus to collect fossils. Previously, some odds and ends had been found by geologists, which happens, and we're basically following the geologists who map these areas and characterize the rock units. Very important pre-work to what we decide to do. And we were able to spend enough time to collect 629 cataloged specimens now back at the Academy of Natural Sciences. They were shipped up, and we've done all the curation, and the research begins on the diversity of forms from that place at that time. And that's what we'll continue to do. And by the way, those fossils aren't just for me and my colleagues to look at. They're for the students from Drexel University to look at, and other students. There are other professionals. An institution like the Academy is basically a library of life, and we love to have others come and share and study there.
Ken, I wonder whether climate change, melting glaciers, has made the work of paleontologists easier in that it has revealed things that might have been buried under, you know, feet, yards of miles of ice.
It can go both ways. So in polar areas where Ted works, you might be seeing new outcrops of rock appear as these glaciers melt. But as the glaciers melt, the water goes into the ocean and raises the level of the sea. So rocks elsewhere in the world that might be of interest to me are being inundated.
Right. And once you went to Argentina, where's Dreadnoughtus now?
We had Dreadnoughtus in Philadelphia for 5 years, and then I sent it back to Argentina to the Museo Padre Molina in Rio Gallegos, Argentina, which is the third most southern city in the world.
Wow. Wow. And where's Tiktaalik?
It's up in Ottawa at the Canadian Museum of Nature. It belongs to the people of Nunavut, though, which is that northern territory up north of the Hudson Bay and Baffin Island. So it is interesting that these discoveries that we get that are made, certainly we're more than happy to have them repatriated to their country of origin. And most of the agreements that we make for permits to collect in these areas require that now. But the beauty is that there's always those opportunities to study these things, to document them in various ways. I know Ken and I have both done 3D scanning of the fossils that we're interested in. So more and more that sort of technology it doesn't make the actual fossils obsolete at all, but they're still important. The 3D scans are also useful.
Well, always fun to talk about fossils and dinosaurs and survival and extinction. Ted Deschler, thank you for joining us today in Radio
My
Times.
Pleasure.
And Kenneth Lacavara, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
And you can go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program. We're going to close things out with Stravinsky's Rite of Spring used as a score of the dinosaur fight in the 1940 classic Fantasia.